It's been a while since we've covered our inclusivity statement, so I'll go ahead and offer that to you tonight. So please just know that regardless of your gender, your skin color, your age, your sexual orientation, your political affiliation, your religion or lack thereof, and whether you're new to meditation or you have many years of experience, just know that you are welcome here. Not only to this class, but any offering at Insight Santa Cruz. And I invite you to check out other classes and other teachers and see what you resonate with. There's a lot of good offerings out there, a lot of good teachers at Insight Santa Cruz. We're very, very lucky to have that. I didn't realize that not every city or town in America has an Insight Santa Cruz for them to visit. In fact, it's actually pretty rare that, to have a center like Insight Santa Cruz. So makes it a little bit easier when we have everything offered over Zoom nowadays. But even when we're allowed to go back into the building, I invite you to go check it out. It's definitely getting dark earlier these days, and I am definitely feeling it. It's feeling a little heavy on me. I feel very tired, and we haven't even turned the clocks back yet. In a couple of weeks, this is what 5:30 is going to look like. So that's not really looking forward to that, but that's all part of it. It's all part of impermanence, seeing the seasons coming and going. It's just another opportunity to practice, right? So tonight we're going to be wrapping up the teachings on the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. And I just wanted to acknowledge that, since we started this course, this core teachings of the Buddha course, we've covered a lot of material. We talked about the life of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, taking refuge in the Triple Gem, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. We talked about the five precepts. We're covering the four foundations of mindfulness right now. Next week, Carol is going to be talking about the three marks of existence. And then after that, we have a whole other unit on the Brahma Viharas. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, that's a lot of material in a short period of time, especially if this is like your first time going through a course like this. And even if it isn't, it can be overwhelming, just trying to take it all in. So, if you're feeling this way, I just wanted to normalize it. I don't want you to stress out about it. We're all here voluntarily. There's no test at the end of this course or anything like that. So you don't need to memorize everything that you hear. If you continue to practice, you're going to hear these teachings over and over and over again. So just continue listening with some curiosity. And maybe the next time you hear a Dharma talk on one of these topics, it'll make a little bit more sense because you've got some familiarity with the topic. You'll recognize the words, the concepts. You'll have had opportunities to practice in your own life. So you'll have personal firsthand experience on what we're talking about here. It's going to become more and more relatable the more that you hear it and practice it. So I just wanted to say that, just wanted to get that out there. Because even when writing these Dharma talks, I was talking to Carol earlier before everyone came on, that even writing these Dharma talks can be overwhelming at times. I mean, there's so many lists, so many teachings, and we only have a short period of time to talk about them. So, I want to make sure that you get all the information, but I just don't want to sit here and like read you a bunch of lists or anything like that. I want to make sure that the teachings are relatable. So, myself included, let's just be kind to ourselves when we start to feel overwhelmed. It's definitely not a sign of failure. It's actually a sign of success. We're recognizing the presence of a unpleasant mind state, right? So again, tonight we're going to be covering a topic that is, it's not always the easiest to teach. It's always kind of funny when we're putting together like the schedule for a course like this. And this is one of those topics that like nobody really volunteers that they want to talk about. there's, you know, I find something similar with equanimity when we talk about the Brahma Viharas as well. That's one where it's kind of just like, it's not like a difficult concept, but it sometimes it can be kind of difficult to teach. And so there's just not a whole lot of, you know, it's one that doesn't get volunteered very easily by teachers. And it just so happens I'll be teaching equanimity in the Brahma Vihara series too. So lucky me, I get to do both. But for tonight, again, we're going to be wrapping up the Satipatthana Sutta, and we're looking at the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the Dhammas. And Dhamma is a Pali word that refers to the teachings of the Buddha. And throughout this course, we've referred to some Pali words, and I don't know if we ever like stopped to explain what that is. So just, you know, quickly, I just wanted to let you know, Pali is one of the languages that was spoken during the time of the Buddha. In his part of the world. So there's also Sanskrit, which was normally spoken by, you know, those in the higher caste system, the upper class. And Pali was spoken by the non-upper class population, you know, people of the streets. And Buddha gave a lot of his teachings in Pali because that's who he was trying to reach a lot of the time. Now, even though he was born into this upper class, you know, he was a prince, a son of a king, he didn't want to just keep the teachings within that caste. So Dhamma is the Pali word that's been translated as teachings of the Buddha. And you may be familiar with the Sanskrit version, which is Dharma. I think Dharma is more commonly used in the Western world, but you know, both ways are fine. They both mean the same thing. And I even find myself going back and forth between the two. So if you hear me say Dhamma, you hear me say Dharma, it's the same thing. And so we started out a few weeks ago with Carol giving a talk on the first foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the body. Even if you've, if you've ever meditated before, this is probably something you've already practiced, whether you know it or not. First thing most of us do when we sit down to meditate is we take note of how we're sitting, right? We make adjustments, we sit up straight, we bring awareness to our posture. And then when we close our eyes, one of the most common instructions is to follow your breath. So we begin to bring awareness to our breath. You're aware of the inhale, the slight pause, there's an exhale, another pause, and then the following, you know, the next breath comes along. So each breath is different. Some breaths are long, some are short, some are labored, some are smooth. We start to pay attention to the breath. So those were the first two teachings in the first foundation. The Buddha also teaches that there's mindfulness with clear comprehension, basically mindfulness of all activities. There's the 32 parts of the body practice, there's reflections on the four elements, and then the nine cemetery contemplations, which are very rarely practiced in the West. So those are all ways that you can practice mindfulness of the body. Then we moved on to the second foundation, when Meg gave a talk on the mindfulness of feeling tones. And this is where we bring awareness to whether a sensation is pleasant, unpleasant, or what we call neutral. Neutral is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And without mindfulness, we normally don't spend too much time thinking about what feels neutral on the body. It's either, oh, that feels nice, or nah, I don't like that. And I find it actually really interesting because most of my body, most of the time, has a neutral feeling tone. Like very few parts of my body are experiencing sensations at this moment that are either pleasant or unpleasant. You know, there's a couple, but I mean, for the most part, what I'm experiencing right now is totally neutral. Yet the sensation I pay the least amount of attention to is neutral. Yeah, and sometimes labeling something as pleasant or unpleasant, it sort of feel like a judgment. And it's really not, though. These human minds and bodies, we're all subject to emotions and sensations. And the truth is, it can either be pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. That's just seeing the reality of what is arising. So these feeling tones are called Vedana, and they can be practiced just like watching the breath. So every time you do something, you know, you try to be aware of whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then last week, we had a guest teacher, Kim Allen, who gave the teaching on the third foundation, which is mindfulness of the mind, or more specifically, the mind states. And this foundation, it helps us look at the quality of our minds and allows us to see whether we are attached or not. We get to see if our mind is feeling greedy, you know, attached to wanting more of something we find pleasant, or maybe we're feeling aversion, not wanting more of something that we find unpleasant. Or maybe you're unclear or confused, which is delusion or sometimes referred to as ignorance, and not as a derogatory term or anything like that. It's because we are ignoring something or refusing to see what is there. And again, this practice is not meant to take us away from the present moment. Quite the opposite, actually. So we don't get lost in these thoughts. You know, rather we see them arise so we can either act skillfully, rather than emotionally or in a reactive manner. And then we let that thought go, just like the breath. So this can be so helpful when trying to redirect the mind's tendency to go negative. And I don't know if that's an issue for you, but it is for me. So being mindful of my mind has really helped me to believe, it's helped me to not believe everything that I think. You know, the thoughts may be real, but they aren't necessarily true. And so I can begin to not take them so personally. So that's just a really quick summary of everything that we've covered leading up to tonight. And if something I just went over doesn't make sense, or you feel like it's incomplete, you're probably right. So feel free to ask anything you want during the Q&A tonight, or you know, I just encourage you just to keep practicing these on your own and just keep coming back to them. I promise this won't be the last time you hear about the Satipatthana Sutta here. We'll have plenty of opportunities to practice with it. So now on to the fourth foundation, which is mindfulness of the Dhammas, of course. And you know, this foundation, it is a little bit different than the first three. The first three foundations are paying attention to what's there. And they do so in an order of, well, I don't want to say obvious or easy, because it's not always obvious or easy, but it's more of like from grand to subtle. So, you know, we start with the first foundation, which is the body. And I feel like the body has a lot of open space to practice with, right? We have this body and everyone is more or less working with the same things. Then when we move to feeling tones, it begins to take on a little bit more of a personal feel, right? So like these feeling tones are happening to me, or, you know, yeah, we all have a body, but these are my feeling tones. So we start to kind of dive into the more personal type of practice. And then when we move to mindfulness of the mind, this is totally personal and very subtle. So even though each foundation is there to help us establish mindfulness, I feel like they progress in a very deliberate order from somewhat obvious or easy to see to a more subtle and personal level. And I get the feeling that the Buddha knew this and was wise enough to know that he shouldn't begin with mindfulness of the mind. You know, it's like you can either concentrate on this one breath at a time or concentrate on the thousands of thoughts that are happening in my mind every minute. So we got to work our way up to that, right? And don't get me wrong, they're definitely not in any order of importance. And it's not like you have to graduate up to the next level or, you know, once you've mastered the first foundation, you never have to think about the breath again. I think it's really just laid out in a nice progression. It helps us get to this next level here. And then when we get to this fourth foundation, which I described, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to explain how it fits in, because it's not so much of a practice like the first three foundations are, but it's more of a list of teachings that will help us look very closely at the process of clinging and letting go. So what we learned in the first three foundations are actually training for this fourth foundation, training for the fourth foundation practices, I should say. And without the first three foundations, it would be very difficult to properly practice the five teachings that the Buddha laid out in this fourth foundation. So I'm going to tell you what these teachings are, just so you can hear it. But again, I don't expect you to memorize these, and I'm actually only going to be concentrating on one of these practices for the remainder of the talk. but the teachings that were included in the fourth foundation are the five hindrances, which are craving, aversion, sloth and torpor, restfulness, and doubt. Then there's the five aggregates, which are form, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Then there's the six sense bases, which are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. There's the seven factors of awakening: mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, relaxation, concentration, and equanimity. And then there's the Four Noble Truths, which you may recall we learned about very early on in this course. And that is that there is suffering in this life, there is a cause to this suffering, there's a way out of the suffering, and that way is the Eightfold Path. And I always thought that that was kind of tricky on behalf of the Buddha. You know, you get all the way to the end of this one list only to find out the last list item is just another list. Kind of sneaks it in there. These teachings, all the teachings in the fourth foundation here, they're all there to help us become liberated, to help us find freedom from suffering, to help us prevent suffering from even arising in the first place. So these are tools that are provided to us by the Buddha, and what tool we use really depends on where our suffering is coming from. So for instance, we have the five hindrances, again, craving, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And I want to focus our time tonight on this teaching because I think it's so important to be aware of these hindrances. So these hindrances are mental states that arise, and they can prevent us from freedom or liberation or nirvana, or whatever you want to call it, or even just suffering less. I mean, maybe full liberation isn't your main goal here. Maybe you just want to suffer a little bit less. Well, these hindrances are distractions. They can prevent you from getting there. These are things that will actually keep us from practicing. And so the first step is to know when the hindrances are present. Because if we're mindful of the mental states, which we learned in the third foundation, we can begin to see when greed or craving arises. We can begin to see when we're restless or when we're sleepy. And the good news here is that each hindrance has an antidote. So once we recognize what is happening, we do have a way of working with it. We also want to recognize when a hindrance is not present. So this might sound kind of odd at first, but if we can become familiar with the feeling of a hindrance not being present, we can start to see how light it feels when it isn't there, right? Like, think about the last time you felt one of these hindrances. Greed, aversion, laziness, restlessness, doubt. Any one of those, I mean, they're not really pleasant feelings, right? It's uncomfortable when we are feeling that way. And so not feeling them is the opposite of that. We may not think of it as necessarily a pleasant feeling. Maybe it's more of like a neutral feeling, but neutral still feels better than unpleasant. And since our minds have this tendency to go towards what feels good, we can actually train our minds to rest in this place more often once we start paying attention to when they're not there. I don't know if any of this is making sense or not, but we can begin to do this by being aware of what conditions are causing the presence or the absence of each hindrance. So we can try to avoid what causes them if possible. It's not always possible, but sometimes it is. And we can also cultivate the conditions that support the absence of them. And it's also helpful to know what conditions support the removal of a hindrance when it's there. And finally, to avoid future arisings of the hindrance. So, you know, basically just to kind of sum up all of that there, When working with these hindrances, what we want to do is know when a hindrance is present and know when it's absent. We want to know the conditions leading to the arising and the removal of a hindrance. And we want to know the conditions that prevent future arisings of a hindrance. So if we look at craving, which is the first hindrance, so craving is the desire for things to be different than the way that they are. And when working with these hindrances, craving is wanting more of what feels good or pleasant. You know, we want a second bowl of ice cream. We want that feeling of falling in love to last forever. We want that excitement of getting a new car to last. You know, we all know it doesn't, but we want it. That's our craving. And this can distract us from our practice because during meditation, craving often leads to daydreaming or fantasizing, maybe even getting up off the cushion to go watch TV or get something to eat, giving into the craving. But the truth of impermanence tells us that nothing lasts forever. And so when we cling to these things or we allow ourselves to get lost in craving, we're going to end up suffering. But the good news about impermanence is that even these hindrances are impermanent. And so the antidote to craving is impermanence. Knowing that one day we will be separated from everything we own and everyone we love will help us to let go when that time comes. You know, we can enjoy it when it's there, but we also need to be ready to let it go at some point. As long as we keep grasping to that, we're going to get rope burn when it leaves us. So the same can go for emotions, you know. We can't always be happy, excited, full of bliss. We need to know that these feelings are also impermanent. It actually helps us not act on our cravings, you know. And we don't have to live like a miserable, horrible life. I'm not saying that, you know, it's bad to eat a slice of pizza when you want pizza, you know, but you know, bigger picture, like what if we acted on every sensual craving that we had? You know, we'd end up hurting a lot of people, including ourselves. So instead, we can kind of sit with that desire, knowing that it's impermanent, and we can make the skillful decision and let it pass without acting on it. So aversion is similar to cravings. The next hindrance on the list, it's the opposite side of the same coin. So this is also the desire for something to be different than the way that it is. But unlike craving, where we want more of what feels good, aversion is wanting less of what doesn't feel good. So getting up or moving around when we become uncomfortable, avoiding unpleasant emotions that we just don't want to deal with. And you know, included in aversion is personalizing difficulties. You know, like when we're stuck in traffic and we think it's like somehow a personal attack against us, and it's not. I mean, it's just traffic. It just happens. You know, we can't take it personally. This can also happen on our meditation cushion. You know, if you you know, back when we could come to Insight Santa Cruz, when you show up for a nice quiet sit and you realize they're doing road work outside and all you can hear is the heavy machines breaking up the asphalt. You know, it's pretty much like it's an unpleasant sound and we tend to take it personally, you know. It's like, don't you know I'm trying to meditate in here? Like, what are you doing out there? And it can get you just to get up and leave, you know. You start thinking to yourself, I can't meditate now. I'm going to just go home. So these are all examples of how aversion can hinder our practice. And the antidote to aversion is compassion. So when you're in the midst of an unpleasant experience, whether it be physical or mental, you can send yourself some compassion. You know, recognize, yes, this hurts. Yes, this is unpleasant. I'm sorry you're feeling this way, and I love you. Just send yourself these compassionate, loving thoughts. Good news is that unpleasant is also impermanent. These feelings will go away eventually. And one of my favorite things that the Buddha taught about aversion and specifically how to work with it is simply think about something else. This wasn't his first recommendation on how to deal with it, but I love how relatable that answer is. when the Buddha was a human being, and I like how human of an answer it is. So, you know, if something is unpleasant and you can't use it as part of your practice, or compassion just isn't available at the time, that's totally fine. Buddha said, just think about something else. It's better than letting your mind run out of control with the unpleasantness. The next hindrance is sloth and torpor. These are fun words to say, but totally uncommon in our language. So they're often summed up as sleepiness, or, you know, something similar to that. And they're often lumped together as well, sloth and torpor, but they're actually two different mental factors. And I'll read you what Joseph Goldstein says about it. So he says that sloth is sluggishness of mind or consciousness, which dispels energy. It is a lack of driving power, and we feel it as kind of a sinking state. Torpor is like a heavy blanket smothering the various mental factors, and we experience it as drooping, nodding, or sleepiness. So sloth has to do with dullness of consciousness, and torpor with dullness or heaviness of the mental factors. I had to read that multiple times. It's a pretty technical description, and it might not be totally clear. So for the sake of this Dharma talk, we can just think of sloth and torpor as a feeling of tired, lazy, lack of energy. This can hinder our meditation practice in several different ways, actually. We may just tell ourselves, I'm too tired to meditate, I'll just end up falling asleep, or I don't want to drive to ISC, you know, again, back when that was an option. Or even just, you know, I just want to lay around and watch TV. I don't even want to get up and start meditating. We get caught up in this lazy state of mind, and it feels like we're moving through molasses. Everything just takes so much effort, and you just don't even have the energy to start. And so the antidote to sloth and torpor is to access a source of energy. Pretty simple, right? You know, if you're feeling tired, just get more energy. Yeah, easier said than done. But there are actually some recommendations that you can try. If we notice ourselves feeling sleepy during a meditation, we can maybe just adjust our posture, you know, by standing up, or even slightly opening the eyes to let some light in. We can get up, we can splash some water on our face, have some tea. In fact, that's a pretty common technique used by monks to stay awake during meditation. They drink their green tea. It helps them stay energized for these meditations. We can possibly engage in some skillful conversation with a good friend, maybe another Sangha member. Talking about the practice can sometimes re-energize our desire to practice. And then sometimes we're just tired, you know? It's as simple as that. We're constantly running around. We're working, we're staying busy, we're staying connected, we're staying up too late, we're not getting quality sleep. Sometimes we just need rest, and that's totally okay. You know, get some rest, get a good night's sleep, and try practicing later. You aren't failing at this practice, you're just being human. So the opposite of this hindrance is restlessness or anxiousness. And this is definitely a hindrance that I have felt many, many times before. Sitting in a meditation and the mind is just running out of control. It's even busier than it usually is. And no matter how many times I try to bring it back to the breath, it's just off and running. There's the physical aspect too, where you're just crawling out of your skin to end the meditation. You can't get comfortable. You can't sit still. Each time you hear a sound in the room, you get excited because you think it's the teacher about to hit the bell, but they don't. And then you have to continue to sit, and it just feels like torture. Yeah, I've been there too many times to even count. And this is a hindrance to our practice because quite often we do just stand up and walk away. Especially, you know, when I go to a center to sit, it's easier to stay. But when I'm practicing at home, I get so restless and anxious that there's so many reasons for me to stand up and walk away. It's really a hindrance that I've had to work a lot with my home practice. And if I'm feeling anxious, I might not even try to sit, because I just tell myself it's not going to be a good sit. So why even get started? I've already accepted failure before I've even started. Restlessness and anxiety, they tend to manifest worry too. So it starts to feel like the snowball effect where I'm too restless to meditate, but not meditating is making me more restless. And it's like a dog chasing its tail. So the antidote to restlessness is mindfulness. The mind is running wild, right? It just wants something to do. So we give it something to do. It's going to be either a breathing or a body scan technique. But if that's not in the cards, I've found it to be helpful just to transition into a walking meditation. It's a different type of concentration practice, but you give your body an opportunity to move around. You give the mind something to concentrate on. Something to try perhaps next time you're feeling restless. And this last hindrance before we finish up here is doubt. And I've heard it said that of all the hindrances, doubt is the most dangerous one, because this is the one that'll make you get up off your cushion and walk away from this practice for good. Doubt can be anything from this practice is bullshit, this practice isn't going to work for me, or even more personal, I'm not worthy of this practice. You know, why do I deserve to suffer less? All the shitty things I've done in my life, why do I deserve less suffering? Doubt is real, and it's real strong. But if we're aware of it, you know, again, thanks to our mindfulness practice, we know how to meet it. So maybe bringing in some compassion for yourself, maybe remind yourself of a time when the Dharma wasn't bullshit. You know, some time where you were just like, yeah, this practice works. Just because you have doubt right now doesn't mean anything except that you're currently experiencing doubt. That's all it is. The antidote to doubt is to encourage curiosity, participation, involvement. Start asking questions about your practice. Become more involved. So the way that we practice with the five hindrances with regards to the fourth foundation is with impermanence. Each of these hindrances is impermanent. It becomes so much easier to defeat the hindrance when you know this. You know, this is doubt, but it won't last forever. This is restlessness, but it won't last forever. The same can be said with the Four Noble Truths. You know, there's suffering in life. There is a cause of suffering, which is clinging, and there is a way out of suffering. Stop clinging. And then there's the Eightfold Path. This was the Buddha's first teaching, and it's all about not clinging. So perhaps another time we can take a deeper look into some of these other practices that the Buddha included in the fourth foundation. And we can see that those practices they're also all about letting go. For instance, when we work with the six sense bases, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking, we work with the impermanent nature of these senses. If something tastes good, you're going to end up suffering if you cling to that taste, because eventually it's going to go away. It's going to be replaced with another taste. Sometimes this happens at a concert. Back when I could go to a concert, I would close my eyes and I would just hear the music, and it would just be so freaking beautiful, you know? But I have to let it go when the song ends. And if the song never ended, it might not be so beautiful. You know, after 12 hours or 2 days or 5 years, I mean, impermanence is actually a really good thing. So, see, our suffering is dependent on how mindful we are and our relationship to clinging. The first three foundations help us cultivate the mindfulness. And then the fourth foundation helps us work with our clinging tendencies. Again, this is a lot to process. Even if just one or two of these things made sense or aroused some curiosity, I think you're going to be all right. You know, again, just please keep coming back. Come to other sits if you can. We have a wonderful library at ISC, and one day we will have access to it again. But, even if you go online, there's plenty of resources to deepen your understanding of the Dhammas and begin practicing these things on your own. Again, finding a source of energy to get involved with your practice, to continue being curious about it. having said all that, let's just we normally just sit for a minute. I definitely want to leave enough time for some questions and comments, but why don't we take 5 minutes and sit in silence and just see which of these hindrances, if any, are coming up. Don't actively, force them upon yourself. If nothing is arising, nothing's arising. That's perfectly fine. But let's see what does arise for us. So sitting exactly how you are is perfectly fine. And again, just allowing the eyes to close if that's available to you. And just reconnecting with the breath. Maybe going back to that mantra we had at the beginning meditation. Breathing in to calm the mind. Breathing out to relax the body. For the next 4 or 5 minutes, we'll just sit in silence and in stillness and see which of these hindrances arise for you, if any at all, and see if you can maybe meet them with the antidote.